Numbers 23, and I'm just going to read all of it. We'll see how that goes. Balaam said, "Build me 7 altars here and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me." Balak did as Balaam said, and the two of them offered a bull and a ram on each altar. Then Balaam said to Balak, "Stay here beside your offering while I go aside. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet with me. Whatever he reveals to me, I will tell you." Then he went off to a barren height. God met with him, and Balaam said, "I have prepared 7 altars. On each altar I have prepared a bull and a ram." The Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, "Go back to Balak and give him this word." So he went back to him and found him standing beside his offering with all the Moabite officials. Then Balaam spoke his message. "Balak brought me from Aram, the king of Moab, from the eastern mountains. Come," he said, "curse Jacob for me. Come, denounce Israel. How can I curse those who God has not cursed? How can I denounce those whom the Lord has not denounced? From the rocky peaks I see them. From the heights I view them. I see a people who live apart and do not consider themselves one of the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number even a fourth of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and may my final end be like theirs." Balak said to Balaam, "What have you done to me? I brought you to curse my enemies, but you've done nothing but bless them." He answered, "Must I not speak what the Lord puts in my mouth?" Then Balak said to him, "Come with me to another place where you can see them. You will not see them all, but only the outskirts of their camp. And from there, curse them for me." So he took him to the field of Zophim on top of Pisgah. And there he built 7 altars and offered a bull and a ram on each altar. Balaam said to Balak, "Stay here beside your offering while I meet with him over there." The Lord met with Balaam and put a word in his mouth and said, "Go back to Balak and give him this word." So he went to him and found him standing beside his offering with the Moabite officials. Balak asked him, "What did the Lord say?" Then he spoke this message, "Arise, Balak, and listen. Hear me, son of Zippor. God is not human that he should lie, not a human being that he should change his mind. Does he speak and then not act? Does he promise and not fulfill? I've received a command to bless. He has blessed and I cannot change it. No misfortune is seen in Jacob, no misery observed in Israel. The Lord their God is with them. The shout of the king is among them. God brought them out of Egypt. They have the strength of a wild ox. There's no divination against Israel, no evil omens against Israel. It will now be said of Jacob and of Israel, see what God has done. The people rise like a lioness. They rouse themselves like a lion that does not rest till it devours its prey and drinks the blood of its victims." Then Balak said to Balaam, "Neither curse them at all nor bless them at all." Balaam answered, "Did I not tell you I must do whatever the Lord says?" Then Balak said, "Come, let me take you to another place. Perhaps it will please God to let you curse them for me from there." And Balak took Balaam to the top of Peor, overlooking the wasteland. Balaam said, "Build me 7 altars here and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me." Balak did as Balaam had said and offered a bull and a ram on each altar. Now when Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he did not resort to divination as at other times, but turned his face towards the wilderness. When Balaam looked out and saw Israel encamped tribe by tribe, the Spirit of God came on him and he spoke this message. The prophecy, Balaam, son of Beor, the prophecy of the one whose eyes see clearly, the prophecy of the one who hears the words of God, who sees a vision from the Almighty, who falls prostrate and whose eyes are opened. How beautiful are your tents, Jacob, your dwelling places, Israel. Like valleys they spread out, like gardens beside a river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. Water will flow from their buckets. Their seed will have abundant water. Their king will be greater than Agag. Their kingdom will be exalted. God brought them out of Egypt. They have the strength of a wild ox. They devour hostile nations and they break their bones in pieces. With their arrows they pierce them. Like a lion they crouch and lie down. Like a lioness who dares to rouse them. May those who bless you be blessed, and those who curse you be cursed. Then Balak's anger burned against Balaam. He struck his hands together and said to him, "I summoned you to curse my enemies, but now you've blessed them these 3 times. Now leave at once and go home. I said I'd reward you handsomely, but the Lord has kept you from being rewarded. It's a long reading. It's a really interesting story to me that I find really strange. Because Balak's the king of Moab. The Israelites have camped along the plains of the Jordan near to Jericho, and Moab's terrified. It's what you read in Numbers 22. And because Moab's terrified, the king of Moab's gone to this prophet, asked him to come to curse these people. Initially, God says, don't go. Then Balak sends some more people, says, we'll give you whatever you want. Balaam's like, that's not why I'm going. But God says, go. And then on the way, an angel stands in front of the donkey. Balaam has a conversation with his donkey. It's all a bit weird. But eventually, he ends up there. And he ends up there, and they take him to a place to see the camp of Israel. This is it. This is what we're terrified of. This great number of people camping here. Balaam goes, right, wait there. I'm going to go and see what God's got to say. Because he's made a commitment to only say what God would have him say. And he's told Balak that when he arrives. I'm only going to say what God would have me say. So wait there, and I'll go and find out what he's got to say. And he goes away, comes back, says something. And Balak's like, what's that? I brought you here to curse them, and you've blessed them. But he doesn't at that point go away, please, because clearly this is not going to happen. He proceeds to take him to two other locations to show him it from a slightly different vantage point to see if he can convince him to curse the Israelites. Actually, if you come and see it from here, maybe then you'll curse them. And Balaam goes away, seeks God, and blesses them with greater strength than he initially did. And Balak's not pleased about that. He's really not pleased about it. But then he says, maybe if we go to this other place, you'll see it slightly differently and you'll curse them then. And it only just gets worse for him. Because now he's blessing them even more, but he's also cursing those who curse Israel. That's Balak. And it leaves me with this question of why would you do that? Why? He's been told this prophet's only going to say what God has him say. Yet Balak spends his time trying to demonstrate his point of view to God. This is how I see it. This is my perspective. Look where they are. Or maybe you can't see it from there. So if I take you to a different point, maybe you'll get an idea now. This is what it looks like for me. If I say it slightly differently, maybe then you'll understand what I'm trying to communicate. And I wonder how often we're trying to tell God of our perspective and tell him exactly what it looks like for us. God, if you could just understand it from my point of view, this is actually what's going on. This is what I see. This is what I think's happening. This is how I feel about it. And we spend our time convincing an all-seeing, an all-knowing God that we know exactly what should happen and what he should do. And if we can't say it one way, we try to say it another. Job 28 and verse 24 says he views the ends of the earth and he sees everything under the heavens. He views the ends of the earth and he sees everything under the heavens. And I'm busy trying to tell him what I see. I actually don't have the capacity to show God a different perspective on issues. I don't have the capacity to inform his view. I don't have the ability to inform him of anything this morning. And I can spend my time trying to show him my point of view. But actually, my point of view is the one with limited information. I'm the one who doesn't see things as clearly as him. I look at what's going on in the earth and I am at a loss. Don't understand the war in Ukraine, have no idea why it would exist, what happens, what's going on in people's hearts, minds, anything. I don't even understand the geography of Ukraine. I've learned more about Ukraine in the past 2 weeks than I'd known for the rest of my life. He knew every person in every city when he formed them in their mother's womb. But he also sees the heart of people. See, quite a lot of my time, I'm trying to guess what's going on in people's hearts and minds. Why would you do that? Why would Vladimir Putin decide to proceed with this unjust, totally evil act? I don't know. 1 Samuel 16:7, the Lord looks at the heart. Psalm 44 and verse 21, God knows the secrets of the heart. Jeremiah 17 and verse 10, I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind, to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his deeds. Fears gripped the heart of this man, Balak, that his kingdom's potentially going to be challenged by this great number of people. So maybe I'll just get God to curse them. And that'll deal with it. But God's already got a plan. That's been in existence for hundreds of years. He spoke to Abraham. Told him he was going to make them a great nation. Told them they were going to inherit the land. Isaac's born. Jacob carries the line on. Joseph moves into Egypt, takes a family in. They come out a nation. But he's promised to bless them and to bless the nations of the earth through them. long before Balak even exists. Long before Balak's even on the scene. Before he's ever a king. Before he's even born. Before his parents are born or his grandparents. God's made a promise to a nation. Because he knows what he's doing. Isaiah 46 and verse 10. I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient time what is still to come. I say my purpose will stand and I will do all that I please. He knows what he's doing. And while I'm wrestling with him about what's going on in the earth and trying to show him what I see, trying to tell him about what I think should happen, he's out working plans that he formed some significant time ago. He's fulfilling promises he made some significant time ago. He's doing what he said because he's always had a plan and he's always going to fulfill it. And unlike me, he's always got the capacity to do what he wants. I don't know if any of you are like me, but quite often I have good intentions. And I know what I think I want to do, but my execution quite often doesn't match my intention. I might start a DIY project with a crystal clear picture about how this is meant to look. And finish it thinking, I really wish I hadn't wasted all this money. Because quite often I don't have the ability to match my intention. That's not his challenge. He is able to do exceedingly and abundantly more than we can begin to imagine. All power and might is his. And so he's fulfilling his purpose. And a king is running from different hill points to hill points, trying to get God to see what he sees. Trying to convince God his perspective's the one that should be pursued. He's come up with something. It's a real and present threat to his people. So this is what we should do, God. You curse them. That'll take care of everything. And I wonder, how much I'm like Balak. Because I think quite a lot of my prayer life is me trying to tell God my perspective on issues and explain to him what he needs to do. If I was to reflect honestly on it, I'd probably spend quite a bit of time telling God what I see and explaining what I think he should do. Maybe it's just me. And I wonder if the invitation of Scripture is actually, you change your perspective. that you fix the focus of your intention according to what he sees. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 16 says, therefore we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So, we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. Since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. Since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. It's a really strange thing to say, isn't it? Fix your eyes on the unseen. Fix your eyes on the unseen. But there's a choice about where you fix your focus. Verse 16, Paul expresses some tension. Outwardly, he's wasting away. That's what he sees. Visibly and clearly, it's the evidence of his life. He's aging. He's been through some significant challenges physically. There is a challenge to this. That's what I see. It's what's evident in the scene. But inwardly, in the unseen, glory to glory, one degree of glory to the next, renewed day by day by the strength of God. That's significantly different. Light and momentary troubles. That's how he expresses it, verse 17. Light and momentary troubles. Light and momentary. But if you were to turn back a few pages, you'll actually read that his troubles are beyond his ability to bear. That's what he says of them in 2 Corinthians. He's faced challenges beyond his ability to bear. It's not a denial of the reality of the situation. And everything in the evidence points to the challenge of this world and the hardship that he's facing. But he's looking forward to a day that isn't seen right now, that isn't evident right now. It's not apparent. In the unseen, though, it's achieving something for him. An eternal weight of glory that far outweighs them all. And there's a choice about where you focus your attention. I'm reminded of the story in 2 Kings 6. Where Elisha has upset the king. So they're in a house doing their thing when his servant wanders out. Suddenly there's armies surrounding them. And understandably, the servant's like, what are we going to do, Elisha? What's the plan here? Like, how do you respond in that? Like, our lives are in serious threat. And Elisha's prayer, he says to the servant, don't be afraid. And then says, God, open up his eyes. God, open up his eyes. And suddenly he sees an army from heaven surrounding them, chariots of fire on the hills around. Do you know what I found really strange about the story, though? What happens next? Because what I'd like to happen in that scenario is that this invisible army from heaven put an end to my enemies, took care of it all. I'll just sit in the house, eat my sandwich, come out when you're done, God, job done. It's not what happens. Like, Elisha says, oh God, blind them. Blinds them, takes them off, feeds them, sends them home. And the army seemed to serve no purpose at all except to be reassurance. The army from heaven seemed to serve no purpose at all except to give peace to a servant who's scared. I mean, you can read the story from yourself and draw your own conclusions, but they actually don't do anything. I wonder what it would be like. If our focus of attention, the thing that we saw from day to day in our lives, was a commitment from a God who said he'd never leave us or forsake us. Can you imagine if you actually saw it? Just God with you. Imagine if everybody else saw it. Who's that like? It's just God. Don't worry. It's all good. Like, what would you do differently? What would you have confidence in that you don't currently? What might you feel differently about? Not because everything's going to change in an instant. Not because you're just going to put your feet up and he's going to take care of all of your life and you don't ever have to do anything again. But it'll give you some level of confidence, wouldn't it? I'm facing this challenge. Big man's here though, so what's the worst that can happen? I have a choice about where I focus my attention. About what captures my mind. And it's not that the things of this world are no longer visible to me, but they're not fixing, I'm not fixing my eyes on them. The reality is I have the capacity to watch too much news. I have the capacity to watch too much news. And it actually steals my focus. And here's the truth. Depending on where you get your news from, will have a significant impact on your perspective on what's happening in the world. There's only one who knows truly exactly what's going on. In every season, in every circumstance. I read a statistic this morning. It said there are currently 40 ongoing wars in the world. 40. I felt humiliated. Because I'm really worried about Ukraine and what's happening in Ukraine. Because that's what's on the news. And I'm not taking away from that situation. But in all sorts of circumstances across the face of the earth right now, people live in terror. Because the nations are at war. I don't see everything that clearly. And even within my own life, I don't think I see things that clearly sometimes. I'm convinced some things are sometimes something other than they really are. The amount of times I've thought God was going to do something at a certain time in a certain place, and he didn't. Though I was convinced that's what it would look like. Because I actually, I don't really see things as clearly as I probably think I do. And I can persuade myself of some stuff that's not reality. I have the capacity to deceive myself. That's the Bible. By just listening to the word of God and not doing it, I can deceive myself. I don't necessarily even see me clearly. And I don't see him as clearly as he sees me. Every hair on my head is numbered. And I couldn't even tell you roughly how many there are. I don't think I could give you a ballpark figure. But he's numbered them all. So I wanted to draw your attention this morning to an interesting story in Numbers 23. Because I think it's relevant for our lives. And maybe I need to make a decision about what focus I give to certain things. And what I'm actually fixing my eyes on. Because I'm going to say, do you, that's essential for you not to lose heart. It's easy to lose heart if what you go is a, I'm outwardly fading away. I'm a mess. Everything's a mess. And all these troubles. Like, what do you do? Like, where do you even begin? And like, I've got all this stuff going on. The preceding verse is, I'm hard pressed on every side, persecuted. In despair. It would be easy to stare at those circumstances, sort of think, what's the point? But easy to stare at those circumstances and go, I don't know how I keep going. To lose heart. But Paul takes time to remind himself, I'm being renewed day by day. I'm being transformed from one degree of glory to the next. And when I see Jesus Christ, I will be like him. This body might fail, but I will see my King, and I'll look like him. I've got a lot of stuff going on. Life's hard. Sometimes it feels unbearable. But it's not forever. And in eternity, the glory that I'm going to see, the things I'm going to encounter, the stuff I can't begin to imagine, it's going to make it all worth it. There's far more going on in most circumstances than we ever acknowledge. There's far more stuff happening. God's doing far more than often we give him credit for. And our understanding of circumstances are very often very limited. I want to fix my eyes in the right place at those times. I want him to open up my eyes to him. And maybe I need to shut up sometimes and stop telling him what I see and ask him what he's doing. Maybe I need to stop telling him what he should be doing and just ask him to minister to me. I actually think God quite likes speaking. And quite often we don't give him enough space to. So we're going to stand together and worship. I hope that was a blessing to you. But make a decision what gets your focus and where you fix your eyes and what perspective you live with.